Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We begin in a moment and talk about the shutdown of the United States Senate with former Senator Gary Hart, who served three terms in the United States Senate from 1975 to 1987, representing Colorado, and he was twice a candidate for the President of the United States. He has a new book, God and Caesar in America, an essay on religion and politics. We'll also talk about the riots in Paris and with Dr. Mark Levine, who's a professor of modern Middle Eastern history, culture, and Islamic studies at the University of California in Irvine. And he is just back from Beirut, Lebanon. We'll be talking to him both about what's happening in Paris and what's happening in Syria and Lebanon. He is the author of a new book, Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil. And we'll look into why, if they don't hate us, certainly the young, unemployed Parisians of Arab descent seem to be very unhappy with the French government. We're looking into the rest of Islamic diaspora in Europe. And then we'll talk with John MacArthur, who's the award-winning journalist and author, and he's the president and publisher of Harper's Magazine, and he's the author of Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, and The Selling of Free Trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the Subversion of Democracy. And we'll be talking to him. I'm speaking with Senator Gary Hart, who served as a member of the United States Senate from 1975 to 1987, representing Colorado. He was twice a candidate for President of the United States. And his new book, just published, God and Caesar in America, an essay on religion and politics. Just before we get into the creeping theocracy in this country, Senator Hart, what was your impressions of the unprecedented shutdown of the United States Senate? Not unprecedented, but unusual shutdown of the United States Senate. I mean, you did serve on the Senate Intelligence Committee, did you not?
I did indeed. I served on what was called the Church Committee from 1975 and 76 that investigated the CIA and other intelligence agencies and made a number of reforms and instituted Senate's congressional oversight. And it was as a result of that we created Intelligence Oversight Committee, which is the subject of was the subject of the Senate shutdown. I think the story is, I don't think there's any hidden agenda there. The Republican-controlled committee was dragging its feet on answering the second question it was asked to answer, and that was, did the administration cook the books? Did they take out any caveats that came to them from the intelligence community? And I think the answer to that is yes, and I think history, one way or the other, will reveal that.
But the Senate Select Intelligence Committee has is not supposed to be quite as partisan as it's become. It's the only congressional committee where the ranking member has almost equal status. In terms of the second inquiry into the intelligence leading up to the war, so-called phase two, there's no question on the part of the Democrats, particularly the Vice Chair, Senator Rockefeller, that there is some foot-dragging going on here.
Well, that's what I was acknowledging. I think there's no question about that.
Well, I mean, back in April, I broke the story that there was indications that the Niger documents, which were the reason why Ambassador Wilson was sent to Niger to investigate this claim based upon these forged documents, that these documents were tasked and forged over here, and we now know that the Italians passed them on, and that even though they didn't go through normal channels, they ended up with the vice president. This is also true of the aluminum tubes, and also true of Curveball, the basis of Secretary of State Powell's case before the United Nations. So there is something deeply dysfunctional about our intelligence when the reasons to go to war somehow bypass the normal channels and end up becoming sold by the vice president.
No, I disagree with your conclusion. There's something deeply dysfunctional about this administration. I think the history of the intelligence will show, because I dealt with the CIA and other intelligence agencies, they always put caveats, qualifying the reliability of their sources and so on. What happened was, when these reports came to the administration, all the caveats were taken out. We know that for a fact. I mean, I think you just skimmed the surface of what was going on. All of the intelligence was cooked.
Well, it's true that the intelligence committees had hearings to interview hundreds of intelligence analysts as to whether or not they were pressured. And apparently only one from INR spoke up and named him being pressured by Bolton. There's definitely a sense that that one has is that it is not a good career move to speak truth to power. So it seems to me that that our intelligence capabilities have been diminished in this post.
Well, there's no question about it.
I mean, it's as though, you know, after 9/11, instead of, you know, the crash and burn, instead of blaming the driver, we're blaming the car here.
I think there's no question about it, and that's, I think it's been pretty clear, and frankly, to move to the principal subject of my book, I think that's what happens when you elect ideologues with a specific agenda. And there was no question that this administration, involving the religious right, involving neocons, involving deep tax cutters, and a bunch of people that were outside the mainstream, were going to follow through. And they've done so on every level. What I think is really scary about it is so much of it was done in secret or without revealing the true motives and intentions of those who were pushing that agenda, including the religious right.
So is it possible that our great meritocracy, the military and the intelligence services, are being captured by ideologues? I mean, where's the pushback coming? Because I understand that not just on the intelligence in the intelligence community, there's this feeling that they've been cowed. There's also apparently a lot of disquiet in the military that this misadventure in Iraq is destroying this institution that has been rebuilt since the Vietnam War.
Well, again, I'd like to turn to the subject of religion and politics, if I may, because I think pushback comes on all fronts. We can discuss the military in a moment if we wish. What progressive forces in this country have not done is push back on the religious right, which has extraordinary influence in this administration, not just on selection of judges, which is scary enough, but they also played a role in the preemptive invasion in Iraq, because they many of them believe apocalyptically that this is the end times, and there are scores to settle, and the right must be distinguished from the wrong and evil from good. First time in American history, I think, where our foreign policy is based on theological principles, evil, good and evil. I don't remember any time in American history where that's been done. So the pushback that I'm trying to provide, and I think Jimmy Carter and others now, is to say, wait a minute, that's not what the Bible says. That's not what Jesus said. Indeed, if you read the Sermon on the Mount, as I go into in this essay, you get a totally different set of values. You get tolerance, you get forbearance, you get honoring of the meek and the lowly, you get honoring and blessings on the peacemakers. You cannot read the gospel of Jesus and come up with where this administration ends up in its religious quest. You come out exactly in the opposite position. So pushback has to come from the military, has to come from ordinary citizens, it has to come from those of us with evangelical backgrounds who read the Bible and the gospel totally opposite from what the religious right is saying.
So how is it then that this insurgency has been so successful? Because in effect what you're saying, Gary Hart, is a minority has captured, I mean, just as we were talking earlier, albeit obliquely, a minority of neoconservatives captured American foreign policy.
Right.
And likewise, a minority of Christian fundamentalists they're in the process of capturing the American judiciary.
I think they've already done it. In the essay, there are several places where I hypothesize how a theocracy works. And I list off the kinds of things that happen, including ministers choosing judges, and then I say, maybe we're not too far from that. That's exactly what's happening. When the phone call comes from the White House, presumably Mr. Rove, maybe the president himself, no one in the White House is being honest about it, to James Dobson and a group of fundamentalist leaders in America to say, we want your support for this nominee, perhaps even before that nominee was put forward, and I'm sure it's happening with a lot of other judges. Consider what might have happened. I like to go back to 1960 when John Kennedy was running for president, and it was the very same kind of people who were saying we can't have a Catholic in the White House because the Pope will be making policy. So let's suppose it's 1961, and they were right, and when a vacancy occurs on the Supreme Court, the president proposes Byron White from the state of Colorado, a Rhodes Scholar, graduate of the Yale Law School, an All-American football player, and Ted Sorensen calls the Vatican and asks the Pope to support this nominee. The religious right would have gone ballistic, and it's exactly the same situation.
Well, Senator Gary Hart, I've heard that conversation that took place between Ken Mellman, an official at the White House, and Dobson, Sekulow, Colson, a number of these ministers. And what was most disturbing about it wasn't not so much the content, because they were pretty careful, was the tone, this kind of triumphalism that indicated that they, these evangelicals, believe that this is their government and this is their moment, and they, in effect, what we think of as our country is their country.
Yeah, and the weird thing is this isn't one-off. I think that my understanding is that these phone calls have been going on once a week throughout the last 5 years. And, there's people worry about special interest influence in politics. There is nothing wrong with religious people being involved in politics, but when one wing of one religion has a veto over policy, the highest judges in the land, military interventions, social policy, and across the board, that is scary. It is not democracy, it is theocracy.
Well, then again, Senator Hart, how do you explain this disconnect that back in the days of Richard Nixon, he talked about the silent majority. Here we are in a country where up to 70% of the people are against Roe v. Wade being overturned, and it is about to be overturned, or at least kicked back to the states before our eyes. 60+% of the country are against the war in Iraq, yet it rages on, with the contractors making money hand over fist. No end in sight, no exit strategy, and in effect, a nascent civil war going on there. The only reason it hasn't broken out into the open is that the Iranians are telling their Shiite clients to keep their powder dry because the Americans are obligingly fighting their enemy, the Sunni. So we've effectively handed over the oil-rich part of Iraq to the Iranians. A monstrous piece of incompetence that Zbigniew Brzezinski refers to as suicidal statecraft. Yet, in the face of this serial incompetence and the theft of the Treasury, there is, again, I feel like, we're the silent majority.
Is that a question? if so, it's a rather long and convoluted one. I guess my answer is I agree.
Okay.
You
well, then
have to say, how did this happen? I'll tell you how it happened. It happened in a very close election in 2000, where one Supreme Court justice made the decision that George Bush should be president. And Al Gore decided at the end of the day not to tear the Republic apart, and we got George W. Bush. Then, despite the fact that he was warned 8 months before 9/11 by the commission on which I served and was co-chairman that terrorists were going to attack us and did nothing, the whole world changed. A man without a purpose, who was in the White House by a whisker, say the least, suddenly had a purpose. And the purpose was supplied by those around him who had declared as early as 1995 that Saddam Hussein had to go because they had a theory, they had a strategy, that we would throw him out, put in a friendly government in Iraq, headed presumably by Mr. Chalabi, who plays, as you know, a large villain role in all this.
Coming to Washington next week, I believe.
And we would use Iraq as our base military base to control and condition the behavior of nations in the region, and by the way, help guarantee the supply of oil to the rest of the world. So there is no question, as Seymour Hersh has said, we tracked down the Taliban in Tora Bora and let them go. And we let them go because we turned our attention in, I think, October, November, December of 2002 to Saddam Hussein. Richard Clark has said every time, he said in as early as January of 2001, Al-Qaeda and bin Laden, the response he got from everybody, including particularly Mr. Wolfowitz and the vice president, was Saddam Hussein in Iraq. They were obsessed with Saddam Hussein for years before 9/11.
Let me just remind the audience again, if I may. I'm speaking with Senator Gary Hyde, who served as a member of the United States Senate from 1975 to 1987. And he was also, as you just mentioned, co-chair of the United States Commission on National Security for the 21st Century, which performed the most comprehensive review of national security since 1947 and predicted that terrorists would attack on American soil almost 2 years or a year and a half before 9/11, wasn't it?
Well, the original conclusion about the threat of terrorism was 99, fall of 99. The recommendation, I mean, our mandate was to report to the next president of the United States. People have often said, why didn't Bill Clinton do what you told him? That was not within our mandate. Our mandate was to report to the next president of the United States, who turned out to be George W. Bush, and it was in that final report that we said, create a comprehensive homeland security capability out of existing assets, and he did nothing.
Well, just in closing, Gary Hart, let me we know what the problem is here, and we are the majority. A minority of insurgents have captured foreign policy and captured the judiciary, and I guess the question that hangs is how are we going to reassert ourselves? We continually look for the man on the white horse to rescue us. Our own opposition here in this country compromise themselves by voting for this war, and they still haven't found their voice. Perhaps we shouldn't be looking for to be rescued by a leader. Perhaps we should start developing a manifesto ourselves.
I've been in the process of that for 10 or more years. I've written books on grand strategy and America's role in the world, a book called The Fourth Power. I think your phrase, push back, is important. That is to say, we don't wait for Hillary Clinton or John Kerry or Mr. Edwards or anyone else to save us. Those of us who have, as I pointed out in this essay, a combination of years of public service and involvement in the political process and an evangelical background, which I've had, I think have to step out, as we have not done for 5 years, and say to what you call the insurgency, the religious right, the nascent theocracy, you're preaching the wrong gospel. That's not what the Christian gospel says. And it's therefore that I hope you're audience, your listeners, will look for God and Caesar in America, an essay on religion and politics, actually published by Fulcrum Books in Boulder, Colorado, but it's on the newsstands now. I think a lot of people are going to buy it and read it.
Surrender unto Caesar what is Caesar's, unto God what is God's.
Exactly.
But again, the from what I understand, the mega churches are growing. Fox News is growing. the Bible is on your side, on the side Jesus didn't carry an AK-47, hate homosexuals, celebrate capital punishment, fly around in a Learjet, and shake down poor people for money. So with all that ammunition on our side, I'm surprised that the other side is growing.
Well, we've got a lot of mega churches in the suburbs of Denver and elsewhere. I know those people, and I grew up among them some years back, people just like them. First of all, I don't think all of them are followers of James Dobson. I don't think all of them voted for George W. Bush. I don't think all of them believe we ought to be in Iraq or harass gay people or any of the rest of it. They just haven't heard our side. If anything has dumbfounded me in politics in my life, and it's been a rather long one, it's the silence the Democratic leadership today on an alternative policy in Iraq and a variety of other things. I mean, I would like to hear Senator Clinton and the others all saying their version of what this essay says, and that is there are a different set of values than those being preached today, and this is a faith and values crowd in power. We have faith and values also, and here's what they are. And I simply don't hear that. Now, I also don't think the press is playing its role. So maybe Senator Clinton and others are giving these lectures and lessons and speeches, and we're simply not hearing them. I do keep that possibility open.
I thank you so much for joining
us. My pleasure. Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Senator Gary Hart, who's the author of God and Caesar in America, an essay on religion and politics. He served the United States Senate from 1975 to 1987, and he ran for president of the United States twice. And we're talking to him both about his book, a subject that we've covered assiduously here for a number of years. It seems to be getting some traction now. And as Gary Hart mentioned, former President Jimmy Carter has just written a book also calling for a spiritual revival as a counterweight to the religious right in terms of true religion as opposed to this mercantile, hateful brew that has such an investment in the end of the world. Let's now talk about the Middle East and also as it affects Europe, given that there are riots going on in Paris for some, I think it's in its 10th day now, and the French police and authorities seem at a loss. The riots are not just in Paris, but in the north, in Strasbourg, in the south, in Cannes and Nice, and also in Avignon, of all places. Dr. Mark Levine is a associate professor of modern Middle East history, culture, and Islamic studies at the University of California, Irvine. He's lived and worked in the Middle East and North Africa for more than a dozen years. He just returned from Beirut, Lebanon, and his latest book is Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil. And let me just begin. I know I want to talk to you about what's happening in Lebanon and Syria, but Mark, what's your feelings about the display of the Muslim diaspora in the heart of Europe, essentially conducting an insurgency for about 10 days now?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on again. I was just in Paris a couple of weeks ago when they had that big 1.5 million person march against the against neoliberalism, against the threat of cutting jobs. And I was a little worried there standing on the streets watching the lack of participation in this huge demonstration by people from the suburbs and by African and Arab working class, because they are really the ones who suffer the most. And what struck me, as now people are calling this latest riot an intifada, is that in fact there's already been an intifada in Paris about 15 years ago. In France, there was something called the Intifada of the Cities, which was waged by basically everyone who was not part of the emerging neoliberal consumerist culture in France. It was certainly part, again, of struggles that were also going on in North Africa and the Middle East, especially in Algeria and the civil war that was just starting or about to start there. And it really showed, it was really a blowback for 200 years of French policy, going back to the invasion of Algeria and the gradual takeover of the French North Africa and Syria and Lebanon. And this is the same thing really repeating itself again today, I think. And it's also striking me that it's happening at the same time that we see the protests and the violence in Argentina. Because there you have, and throughout Latin America, an indigenous movement that has really bear the brunt of colonialism, of European takeover of their societies, and finally have had enough and asserting themselves. Well, here in France, you have the indigenous, the colonized, who are now living in France, who can't leave, and who are refusing to play by the rules. And that's really what I think is happening there.
Well, I think there was a pretty hefty dose of anti-Americanism in the and anti-George W. Bushism in what happened in Argentina. But in France itself, what is the reason for, since you've written this book, Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil, Mark Levine, it's clear that the Islamic diaspora in lots of Europe, and particularly in France, isn't assimilated. The Europeans themselves are looking to the American melting pot model. So what's your diagnosis for this problem?
Well, first of all, it's a combination of economic and cultural aspects. Economically, there's been a decline of the traditional working class in France because of also the same structural changes in the French economy that happened in the UK in the 70s and 80s and 90s and has happened here. So we can't just say because they happen to be of Muslim descent. In fact, to this very day, although the numbers might be getting smaller, the majority of young people do not identify themselves primarily as practicing Muslims. So to say this is something about Islam, what is happening clearly, and when I've been to the suburbs and seen, is that the Islamist forces, the more conservative religious forces, are certainly capitalizing on this because especially the left still to this day is not offering a home or any kind of ideas or ideology that these young, poor, largely unemployed or underemployed Muslim or North African youth can latch onto. So part of it is a failure of the left in France, which is still very, in many ways, anti-Muslim. And you can see that from the scandals over people like Tariq Ramadan and other European Muslim figures I'm sure you know about. And then if there's no one there within the French left to offer them an alternative to the French right, the only people that seem to be talking about their concerns is the religious forces, who by and large in France are largely conservative and espousing a version of Islam that is producing what we could call a ghetto Islam in Europe rather than the kind of Euro-Islam or European Islam that more progressive Muslim forces in Europe are desperately trying to create.
And how would you compare it to the United States? I mean, we don't have riots in Dearborn, Michigan.
Well, again, economically, the Muslim communities in the United States are much more integrated economically to the American mainstream. Also, a lot of the Arab communities, let's say in Dearborn, at least until recently, were more Christian Arabs than Muslim Arabs and had a long-term presence going back to the Syrian and Lebanese diasporas of a century ago. So it wasn't the result of colonialism. Whereas in France, the Muslim communities in France, and especially the North African ones, are clearly the result of a very painful and destructive, well over a century of French colonialism there that carried over, that was the result of republicanism. I mean, when people say this is a failure of these people to adapt to French republicanism, it's very ironic because all the people who are saying that don't seem to remember that French republicanism was at the core of French colonial policy. So there's a lack of understanding by too many people in France of their own culture, how it's made the alienation of so many of these young people, you know, impossible to overcome within the Republican model. And that's really why it's so hard for anyone. I see all these ministers, I look at the French press, they're all sitting there in these meetings saying, well, what do we do? And no one can really talk about it because it would talk about questioning the very nature of French identity, especially political identity, which has marginalized these people for well over a century. That's really the problem that no one wants to grapple with yet in France.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure that it's entirely related, but here in Los Angeles today, on Sunday, there's a demonstration with the Iranian diaspora, which is split, half demonstrating in favor of the regimes who, just as you probably know, call for Israel to be wiped off the map. And so there are half that support the regime and half that are appalled at this regime. So it's as though the politics of the Middle East are inextricably bound, both in this country and most certainly in Europe.
Well, I mean, you cannot separate. I mean, the Iranian diaspora is a very specific case as opposed to, let's say, Dearborn, because the Iranian diaspora is quite recent. Most of them came since the overthrow of the Shah. You've had a strong presence of people who, if they didn't identify specifically with the former Shah's regime, certainly were more secular and more supportive of Western culture. And more recent emigres or people who are the children of those emigres who feel in a way similar to you saw in London with some that became sadly evident with the bombings in July 7th, of the children of people who've had some success who nevertheless turn against the host culture because of the continuing racism towards their larger cultural religious group. So it's not surprising. It's very sad that people would be marching and endorsing someone saying like that. But again, even the Iranian president's remarks have to be contextualized vis-a-vis America's remarks when you have leading politicians saying we're going to end states that support terrorism against us, of course, not if they're engaging in terrorism against people we don't care about, or, you know, the idea of regime change, of celebrating creative destruction of what's happened in Iraq. These are all very similar in substance, if not in the exact words. Maybe they're not as crude as wiping Israel off the map, but they certainly, to a Muslim, would have a very similar feeling. And we need to accept the power of our own language, especially when it's actualized by this occupation in Iraq that's killed 100,000 Iraqis and, you know, basically destroyed the economy of the country.
Well, but the beneficiaries of our mistake in Iraq are the Iranians.
The beneficiaries are certainly the Iranians. I also think that there's a lot of beneficiaries within American corporate and political culture that we're not thinking about that are not at all that unhappy with the way things are going.
And you mean you noticed that Exxon's had the highest profit in the history of corporate America in its last quarter, and of course Halliburton continues and the other contractors continue to be the only winners in this war in Iraq. But Mark Levine, let me turn to the subject of your book, Why
Sure.
They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil. You were just back from Beirut, Lebanon. There is this sense that I've had for some time from talking to people in the region that the regime in Syria is, in fact, one analyst described it as a low-hanging, overripe fruit ready to fall. There is some disquiet, apparently, about the possibility of this sort of mafia regime of the Assads the Alawites in Syria falling. Apparently the Israelis are concerned about it. It might be replaced by the Muslim Brotherhood. Nevertheless, the Bush administration, perhaps predictably, are being belligerent and doing probably what they can. I know the special forces and other military units on the Iraq-Syrian border have made incursions into Syria and killed a number of Syrian troops. So give us your analysis of where things are likely to head.
Well, I think certainly the key word that you said was a mafia. And I think this Hariri assassination, assuming the Mehlis report has a grain of truth to it. And
that's the United Nations report.
Yes, the United Nations report about at least beginning to investigate who was behind Hariri's assassination. You know, when I used to go to Lebanon a lot in the 90s, people were not very happy with Hariri. He was seen as someone who was really bringing in a neoliberal worldview. He was destroying, he was taking the downtown that used to be a strong working class popular center. He was rebuilding it as basically a place for elite tourism. The poor and the working class were not doing well. He brought Lebanon's debt, ballooned it to, I think, $40-something billion. So he was not a beloved figure by all when he was still alive. But what was happening is he was taking Lebanon, which is absolutely crucial. The racketeering, I mean, basically what Syria has done in Lebanon is a racketeering. It's basically sliced off the cream of the Lebanese economy for years, without which the regime, the Ba'athist state, could not survive because the Syrian economy is in such a shambles. And he was he basically said to Assad that, or said to the Syrians that, I am going, by his actions, I am going to take Lebanon, and I'm going to take it out of your control, and I'm going to incorporate it into this new globalized economy. It may not necessarily have been better for most Lebanese, because certainly we know the results of when countries get incorporated into the world economy, but it certainly was going to be a disaster for Syria, which is why you have Assad saying, I will break Lebanon over your head. I mean, just sounding like some, you know, mafia thug in a bad remake of The Godfather. And if you look at the people who apparently were behind it, the intelligence, the members of his family, his brother, his brother-in-law, these are people who are from a local mafia that, unlike other mafias like South America or the Sicilian mafia, have not been able to figure out a way to come to terms with and profit from the emerging neoliberal global order. And because of that, the only way they could respond to the threat of losing their main source of income was to do a desperate act. What I've seen, though, in looking at Lebanon, in Syria now, doing more research, is that you see the regime or the structure of the state really starting to crumble at the edges. In the main Syrian, official Syrian news website, there's an advertisement for a big real estate development, a gated community by a large Dubai-based conglomerate, a real estate conglomerate, which is unheard of in Damascus a decade or so ago. This kind of creeping neoliberal entree of gated communities and islands of wealth. They've interviewed some Syrian jihadis, and they said they've wanted to go to Iraq primarily for the sex. They've tried, they were looking for sex and adventure that they can't have in Damascus, and which reflects the frustration of young Syrians who have no hope in the future to get married, to have a normal life. The idea of the Syrian middle class and merchants and traditional entrepreneurs who've been stifled by the regime unless they were co-opted, who just like in Turkey would be dying to be part of the global economy because of how they're left out of their own economy. When you look at all these forces, really Assad is in a lot of trouble.
And what then is likely to happen if this rotten edifice collapses from its own corruption, and now that it's lost its cash cow in Lebanon, there is some expectations amongst analysts that the Muslim Brotherhood will replace it, and that we'll go from a corrupt secular regime into a religious fundamentalist regime.
You know, I first of all, I think if the Israelis are a little bit scared of something happening, that probably means that the U.S. and others are going to go a little slow, because if the Israelis are scared, then people, I think the last thing people want is a Muslim Brotherhood regime. Although, again, the Muslim Brotherhood is not Al-Qaeda, right? We can't just assume because the group has the name Muslim Brotherhood that they're going to be a bunch of fanatical jihadis who are going to, become like the Taliban. This is a group that, if it's true to its more well-known Egyptian brothers, it would not be a disaster. They certainly would make the country much more conservative. It might rhetorically take a more belligerent tone with Israel, but let's be honest, Syria is in no position to engage in any kind of military confrontation with Israel. It would be disastrous. So I'm not sure what exactly would be the horrific result if he went. I don't see how the Muslim Brotherhood would just take over. There would have to be some sort of elections. They're not going to engage in a coup or some kind of, political takeover of the state apart from elections. So I don't think it would be that much of a disaster, but I do think that people are trying to push an internal move, maybe help the regime crumble, cut out its legs more and more. I don't think there's going to be an attempt to really topple the regime from outside or help anyone on the inside topple it, because the chaos would be even worse.
So there isn't a third way then here. I mean, obviously, with a dysfunctional country like this, you still, even with all this unemployment, you still have this talent in this country. They're an educated people. So has this corrupt regime not allowed any other space?
No.
You're either a mafia crook or a secret policeman or a military type, or you're a religious nut. I mean, there's got to be something in the middle.
And certainly there is. And Syria, one of the most interesting things is that while Syria has been one of the more marginalized countries from in the Middle East, from the world, from the globalized economy, which is saying something since the Middle East is pretty much structurally marginalized from the global economy, you can see that Syria managed to maintain a level of relative equality outside of the regime and their allies who take a lot of the money, but a relative equality, lack of absolute poverty, levels of education, and also when you put the entrepreneurial tradition of Syria for centuries, which it was famous for, there's certainly, when Assad the son came to power, he has been trying for 5 years to really build the reform, slowly put in the kind of reforms that would take it to a market economy. But in the meetings of the Central Committee of the Ba'ath, or the economic committees earlier this year, there were huge arguments over whether Syria should say it's moving to a market economy or a social market economy. People do not want to have Syria suddenly become a neoliberal paradise, because people are aware of what that's going to mean and how it's going to skew inequality and have wealth get much more concentrated, even this regime. These are the things that, so I think that class there is desperately trying to figure out a way to move faster than it's been moving so far, but not precipitate a kind of fall that would allow a neoliberalization of the economy before anyone could do anything to hold it off.
Well, just in the last minute, I'm sorry we're running out of time here, Dr. Mark Levine, but tell us why, as your title of your book says, why they don't hate us.
Well, I think basically the first thing from traveling and living in the region for so long is we need to stop talking as if there's one they and one us. And secondly, we need to realize that if you travel around the region, there are so many Muslims, even religious Muslims who consider themselves radicals, but they say we're radicals in a good sense, who desperately want to build real democracy, peace, and justice. And they're trying to reach out, and they'd love to reach out to people in the West, in Europe, in the U.S., to try to build the kind of solidarity that could do that against both our own governments and their governments. And the book, really, the goal is to introduce Americans and Europeans to these people and to help us understand that if we can all have the same dialogue, if we can all have the same discourse of really demanding one standard for all governments throughout the region and demanding that our stand up and force our governments to confront what we've done and help support them instead of obstructing or ignoring them, we will go a lot farther to building the kind of peace and democracy that everyone says we want in the region.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Levine. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Dr. Mark Levine, who is a professor of modern Middle East history, culture, and Islamic studies at UC Irvine. He's the author of a new book, Why They Don't Hate Us, Lifting the Veil on the Axis of Evil. I'm now speaking with John MacArthur, who's an award-winning journalist and author and president and publisher of Harper's Magazine. He is the author of Second Front, Censorship and Propaganda in the Gulf War, and the selling of free trade, NAFTA, Washington, and the subversion of democracy. He has written a new piece in the Providence Journal, which blasts liberal hawks who supported the Iraq War, and in some cases still do. John MacArthur, it seems that in spite of the insurgency in Iraq getting not as much attention as it should, and I don't think it's the seriousness of it is understood, but there is also two insurgencies in this country that have been incredibly successful. One, the insurgency on the part of the neoconservatives who captured American foreign policy and got us into this disaster in Iraq, and two, the insurgency on the part of Christian fundamentalists who have captured the judiciary and appear to be poised to reverse the 5-4 ruling on women's rights, labor rights, and the environment. How did these insurgencies over here take place with such alacrity? It's as though we are the silent majority that Nixon once talked about.
Yeah, I didn't know we were going to be so historical, but I have an answer for that, and that is you can thank the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party in 1980 threw out almost, or tried to throw out, their own nominee, Jimmy Carter. And they did it on behalf of what I would call a political oligarchy that is now dominant in this country, and they were punishing Carter for his independence. And in retrospect, some people think of Jimmy Carter as a kind of a sad sack and a guy who gave in too easily to the Pentagon, and he's tarred with the disgraceful situation in Iran because they allowed the Shah to come into the United States for treatment and so on and so forth. So he looks bad in some ways in retrospect, but if you go back to the States, you realize he was actually the best thing that ever happened to the Democratic Party, the most independent guy. He famously said that you can't blame the American people for Vietnam, you have to blame the government, which was a radical, radical thing, and they punished him for his independence. And that helped bring Reagan in, and that brought in many, many years of counter-revolution against the New Deal, against secularism, against a more limited foreign policy, which we thought was pretty firmly established after the Vietnam horror. And the Democrats to this day are appeasing the forces of darkness, of religious divisiveness, of Christian fanaticism, and of what I call neo-Wilsonian foreign policy, which is a kind of a horrible mixture of self-righteous Wilsonian liberation theology, you might call it, and right-wing sort of power-hungry ambition, which is, I've never seen something like this kind of a coalition. And that's what I was writing about in the column, was the fact that so many liberals in this country who ought to know better have thrown in their lot, not only in the Democratic Party, but in journalism, with the power-hungry, reactionary forces that you're talking about in Iraq and in other areas.
So I guess their finest moment, to be cynical, was the October 02 vote on the authorization to go to war in Iraq.
Yeah, and they applauded it. I mean, the liberals I'm talking about, and some of the intellectuals that you may have heard of, people like Paul Berman, and now this author George Packer, and Samantha Power, Michael Ignatieff. There's a fairly long list of these sort of, I guess I call them neo-Wilsonians, who were delighted to see the vote in 2002. They didn't care what pretext was used to get the vote or how fraudulent it was, and they thought of themselves as being intellectually consistent, because they were, some of them were horrified by Rwanda and the failure to intervene there, but a lot of them supported the bombing of Serbia, which was also accomplished without UN approval, and which was just as much a violation of international law as the invasion of Iraq. And that's where the big split came between people like me and what I call the neo-Wilsonian hawks. They think they were doing God's work by supporting the bombing of Serbia and the alleged rescue of the Kosovars. And they didn't understand what they were doing, because the neocons who have followed always cite Kosovo and the bombing of Serbia as a precedent, a preemptive action, a preemptive war in the name of human rights to justify the invasion of Iraq.
But they pale in significance, these people, to the real players who voted for that war. After all, they were the United States senators. One who ran as the head of the ticket, John Kerry. One who's apparently running in 08, Hillary Clinton. Vice President in the last cycle, John Edwards. Very few. I mean, I remember speaking to the former chair of the Select Intelligence Committee, Bob Graham. He voted against it. He knew that the NIE was completely bogus. And now, of course, we're learning that the entire, essentially what the neocons and the vice president did, and Cheney did in this case, was they essentially manufactured their own evidence for war, fed it back to themselves as a justification for this war. So the best, just this week on CNN, Senator Feinstein, senator here from California, said that she says that we were duped, and if she had known what she knows now, she would never have voted.
It's so preposterous to say she was duped, because there was so much evidence that they were manufacturing the case for war even before the vote was taken. I cited some of it in print and on television, and there was, of course, Scott Ritter, and there were other people. I said a million times, if there was one Scott Ritter shooting his mouth off about how phony the case was, there were a dozen Scott Ritter types, experts in arms control, who reporters simply had to ferret out to get their opinions. People like David Kelly, the scientist who eventually committed suicide in England. People like David Albright, who finally did come forward and say that the aluminum tube story was a fraud, that there was the aluminum tubes that the Iraqis were supposedly trying to buy were not for nuclear weapons purposes.
Well, anybody,
there was ample evidence that this thing was a fraud, and the Democratic Party let down their relinquished their constitutional duty to examine this, and got rushed into it because of a very effective propaganda campaign, and also because a lot of them supported the invasion. A lot of them were, as I say, neo-Wilsonians who think that America has a God-given right to liberate, supposedly, or maybe we should say Protestantize the world, And that gives us license, moral license, to do anything we want in the name of liberty.
Well, it was Condoleezza Rice who helped sell the aluminum tube story. That one was particularly absurd, given that they were the aluminum casings for 122-millimeter rockets, which meant they were 122 millimeters in diameter.
Yeah, they were for conventional rockets. You didn't have to be a weapons expert to figure that out. And in fact, the game was given away. And I've cited this press conference 100 times. September 7th, 2002, Bush and Blair come out and say that we've got a new report from the International Atomic Energy Agency saying that Saddam is, I forget, 6 weeks away or 3 months away from developing a nuclear weapon. There was no new report. All you had to do was call Vienna, and the spokesman would have told you there was no report. It was utterly manufactured, and the press just let it go.
Well, the IAEA, when they finally got hold of the NIJA documents, took them about a few hours and a Google search to prove them to be fraudulent. So one wonders how these tawdry confections became the sales tools for a war. Back in April, I broke the story about how the NIJA documents were, according to a number of high sources in the intelligence world, forged over here, or at least tasked over here.
Well, we don't know who forged them, but somebody forged them.
And they were fed through the Italians.
And now there's a story in today's paper that the Defense Intelligence Agency said that the principal Iraqi source for the Al-Qaeda Saddam connection, which of course was preposterous on its face, was lying, that they believed he was lying, and they said so well before the Bush administration asked for war authorization.
Well, the FBI...
But Cheney and company kept saying, oh, no, this is Carl Levin just got this document released. But Cheney and company just kept saying, oh, no, we have a good source who says that there's a Saddam Iraq connection.
Right. Well, the FBI has pictures of Mohammed Atta in Florida when he was supposed to be in Prague.
Right.
But
he may have gone to get a cheap airline ticket. It is true that he may have been in Prague, but he went simply to buy a cheap airline ticket.
Well, one of the reasons the intelligence business, the people in the analytical world got rolled, was that they simply couldn't believe the absurdity of the Niger claim, since everybody knew that Saddam already had 700 metric tons of yellow cake sitting in a warehouse outside of Baghdad he couldn't use.
Right.
So I guess what I'm getting at here, John MacArthur, is this really just a replay of what we went through during the Cold War? Somehow or other in this country, the right wing, the John Wayne patriots, have usurped the high ground. They've captured the flag. They've captured the Bible. And the Democrats have always been on the defensive in terms of the patriotism. They're the Me Too patriotic party. And they're terrified of, in the Cold War, they were terrified of being soft on communism, and Bush, who was fortuitous in Osama bin Laden attacking this country and it rescued his presidency, he's been able to use the war on terror in the same way. Are you soft on terror?
Well, I think you're being a little too charitable to the Democrats in suggesting that they're a Me Too party. They're much more aggressive than that. They're much more pro-war, pro-military than that. I mean, after all, it's the Democrats who really made Vietnam, Vietnam. And traditionally in this country, the Republican Party is the party of restraint and caution. And indeed, a lot of people were duped, including, I suppose, me, in hoping, or at least it was wishful thinking, that Bush would follow a less bellicose line than Clinton, that he would be less inclined to start a war because Republicans are usually more nationalistic, more defensive, in the tradition of the Arthur Vandenberg wing of the party, which opposed, which was quite isolationist in the 30s. And the Democrats are often the war party in this country, Korea, Vietnam. And here I think you see that tendency coming out again. There was they're very, very pro-war in the Joe Biden, Hillary Clinton wing of the party. And indeed, Clinton and Biden are calling for more troops. They're not saying let's get out. They're saying let's send more troops. But I think that's what Kerry probably wanted to do if he got elected, which would get more troops killed, more people killed, and get us deeper into the quagmire. My hope is that there's going to be an insurgency within the Republican Party, that the revolt is going to come from the right wing of the Republican Party, the isolationist wing of the Republican Party, against Iraq.
But just in closing, John MacArthur, I mean, I don't know that we have much choice in this country. So there are two parties, they're essentially shells. You make your coalitions before the elections under the American system, not after. And if the right-wing religious zealots can capture the Republican Party, I don't see why people that you would support, whose ideas you would support, can't capture this empty shell of a party.
Look what happened to Howard Dean. Howard Dean had popular support. Polls show that he could, some polls show that he would do better against Bush than someone like Kerry or Gephardt. I've been told that there was internal Republican polling that said Dean was the strongest opponent to Bush because of his anti-war stance. And look what happened. The Democratic Party destroyed him in Iowa. They went in with a heavy amount of money, 527 money, and the Republicans went into Iowa, too, with money because they were scared of Dean. And he's running on a straight anti-war platform. Now he's been co-opted and shut down, and he's learned his lesson, apparently. And there is no anti-war tribune in the Democratic Party. So I don't have my fingers crossed. I just had a debate on the Canadian radio with Pat Buchanan about this. He thinks the anti-war movement is more likely to come alive in the Democratic Party. I'm not so sure.
Well, you're not giving us much hope here, because it seems to me that, again, the polls indicate that the American people, up to 70% against this war, against Bush, and in favor of a woman's right to choose. And all of these things are being blithely ignored. We have this crony kleptocracy running this country.
Yeah.
I fail to see how this silent majority can't find its voice.
I hope they will, but I think it's just as likely they'll find it through a Republican senator like Chuck Hagel as they will find it within the Democratic Party, because the big money in the party is pro-war, certainly anti-withdrawal. And they have the example of Howard Dean, who had a lot of money, a lot of grassroots support, tremendous popular support, who was absolutely cut to bits by his own party. The way, to some extent, Jimmy Carter was cut to bits weakened in the primaries in 1980. And there's a lot of intellectual support. That's what my column was about, from the George Packers of the world in his awful book, that's still saying, well, we think Iraq is winnable, and let's not cut and run, and think of the poor Iraqis, and so on and so forth. And they don't give a damn about the poor Iraqis. What they care about is their own self-righteous moral senses of themselves. They want to be right so badly that they can't admit that they were wrong about this.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles, John MacArthur. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters here, speaking then with John MacArthur, who is the publisher of Harper's Magazine. This program and all previous programs are available at ianmasters.org. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer, and Rusty Wynn, and Carol Coote, the associate producers.